Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioral change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Sylvia Galusa. She's a strategist and futurist who lives in San Francisco. She founded Silicon Humanism, which is a research and consulting company dedicated to helping people think strategically about the future and regain agency over their own future. She grew up in France and moved to the States when she was 25. Back in the day, she studied philosophy and sociology and anthropology. She speaks French, German, Chinese, and Italian. Plays the piano, the violin, paints in her free time. She's also a runner and a tennis player. All sounds deeply interesting and all the rest of it. So, Sylvia, hi, and how are you?
Hi, Sean. Thank you so much for the kind introduction. I'm so glad to be here today. Thank you for having me.
No, not at all. I'm really looking forward to this conversation because we've been holding off for a while and just fascinated to go through your viewpoints. I mean, as with all these things, it's great to get a sort of a bit of a grounding, first of all, in terms of how you got to where you are now, and your job as a futurist is incredibly interesting. I mean, I think it's really particularly interesting talking with you about this because there are so many people now that describe themselves as futurists, and there are many pretenders to the throne, but some do it incredibly well, and you certainly are one of them. So go on then, Sylvia, just talk us through your journey to where you are now and what you actually do in terms of your everyday job as a futurist.
Thank you, Sean. So indeed, my name is Sylvia. I'm both a business strategist and a professional futurist. I live in California, been there for 15 years now. And as you were saying, I'm the founder of Silicon Humanism, a research and consulting company. And we are indeed dedicated to helping people think, you know, strategically about the future. And as you said, regain agency over their own future. And as you were saying, I have many, many diverse interests. And as a consequence, I have always been interested in multidisciplinary approaches. I actually have a strong belief that the solution to most of our human problems resides in those multidisciplinary approaches. Mm-hmm. That we really need to work it together, that we need to combine all of our skills and expertise to address human and social issues more holistically, if I may say. So that's why I really found my calling as a futurist, as we address such complex issues, which requires a lot of collaboration, crossing different perspectives, and leverage skills from experts from very various fields, be it researchers, scientists, economists, business leaders, entrepreneurs, educators, strategists, designers, storytellers, and also artists. So from very diverse backgrounds. Personally, how do I approach the discipline? Well, I developed three tracks along my career, first in France and then in California. And if I may sum them up. Thank you. So the first one is about technology product design. So I started my career at Accenture and then worked for a spin-off of Accenture with customers who were large corporations, but also startups. And I worked for media, entertainment, and telecommunication companies. So it was more about, let's say, IT and product design. But there's a second track in my career that arrived a little later, which is more around a strategy for tech companies. And I worked with different startup accelerators. That's actually what brought me in the US. I was working for Business Friends and then French Tech Hub. And then there was a company that we founded called Big Bang Factory with two other co-founders. And what we did for a long time was go to market strategy, how to help tech companies enter the US market. So we would kind of give them the key to the market, how yeah. to launch, how to adapt the product locally, but how to also localize your marketing, your communication, your website, how to build the local partnerships, and how to raise funding locally. And more recently, this brought me actually to come up with this idea of go to metaverse strategy, how to enter the metaverse as a new territory as well, and how can we launch brand activations in the metaverse. So that's kind of the big second track. And the last track, which actually relates to futurism, you were just mentioning it,
yep.
Which we call usually more specifically futures studies, futures research, or strategic yep. foresight. And this is after I was trained with Institute for the Future, I founded Silicon Humanism with the idea to really include more human-centered design and ethical tech as we think about the future. So not just the technological aspect of the future, but really all this holistic aspect we were mentioning.
Fascinating, that issue about human-centered design, which obviously is just at the center of everything one could say. And we'll talk about the metaverse hopefully in real detail in a while, but just going back slightly, I thought it was really interesting. We were talking earlier on looking at scanning the future and looking for signals that may tell us what's on the horizon, what's coming towards us. And again, you mentioned earlier on the fantastic William Gibson, which is someone who always has to have a big shout out. So just perhaps let's talk a bit about that, about the idea of signs and signal.
Yes, sure. So yeah, as you were saying, a lot of people would love to be futurists, and we would love to have more of them. But there's also a specific methodology to study the future. And we have different approaches. Some are more quantitative, and the ones I'm really following is the one from Institute for the Future. And if I may detail it, because that's how sure. we came up with this idea of signals of the future. But maybe an important thought to start with really revolves around the very concept of agency. So contrary to someone who would make predictions, the job of a futurist doesn't consist into predicting for sure what will happen in the future, but really in contributing to building it. So we make hypotheses, we build scenarios, and then we take actions according to this scenario. So a futurist mindset really aims to not fear the future, but look it right in the eyes and find the inner and collective resources to act upon the future. And that's the core of our mission of Silicon Humanism. It's to provide the tools to embrace the future, be it to help create the positive scenarios we can imagine, or on the opposite, to help prevent the scarier ones, so we can be more harmful maybe for our societies or our planet, our humankind, and so on. So as you were saying, futurists, they deal with these raw materials. This is like the subject of our study. We call them signals of the future, sometimes weak signals or signals of change. And as you were saying, and really rightly mentioning William Gibson, we love this quote, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. So the signals of change, they are all around us, and they can be scientific breakthrough, a change in demographics, political shifts or social shifts, new behaviors, an innovative technology, a disruptive business model, an emerging brand, and even the success of a TV character, a TV movie character, an inspiring personality, and so on. So in my everyday job as a futurist, I constantly scan this environment for such signals of the future, and we do it in really every dimension, in the social, technological, economical, environmental, political, and even legal and ethical. So we like to call it steeper with all the initials of those words. And it used to be pastel, and then we evolved it to include ethical recently. So we analyze, we scan in all those dimensions. And then what we do out of those signals is we analyze them, we try to identify what's really happening under the signals, what trend is emerging. So the underlying factors of change that we like to call the force of the future. And it's actually an everyday activity that all of us can practice, and I really invite you to do it as well. if I may say, or maybe you have a question around this, let me know.
No, I thought, again, it's really fascinating and linked to that. You mentioned the whole issue about the ethical angle has really, really come to the fore recently, along with that of empathy. You're talking earlier on about sort of human-centered design. I thought the other issue that you mentioned earlier on, we're talking about this, was the alternative scenarios put forward by Jim Dator. Perhaps you can just talk a bit about that.
Sure. So that's actually the next step in the methodology. When we have this raw materials that we try to work with and to malleate and so on, then we would extrapolate those signals using different methodologies from our, let me call it the futurist toolbox. So sometimes we use the futures wheel when we elaborate out of different dimensions, or we map the future. There are the four alternate futures that you are talking about by Jim Dator. We also do sometimes guided meditation, guided envisioning, trying to project people into really seeing and feeling the future. And we also work with design fiction and so on. But what's important in all those instances, we elaborate plausible scenarios. And what we want to do, once again, is not predicting one future for sure, but really avoid simplified scenarios. We want to avoid, for example, the dichotomy between collapse scenario, catastrophe scenario, and utopia. Yep. We want to engage with various plausible futures. So indeed, the method I really like to use, the four alternative scenarios by Jim Dator, consists into stretching your scenarios into four plausible scenarios. The first being about growth. Mm-hmm. The second more about constraints. The third about collapse. And the last about transform. And this really forces us to stretch our mind, our future thinking ability in plausible directions. Mm. And as I was saying, like with this idea of futures and visioning, we try to make these scenarios as vivid as possible. We want to give to see, to feel, to experience the future to our stakeholders when you work, for example, with entrepreneurs, business leaders, investors, civil servants, innovation teams, and so on. And really, rather than long demonstrations, we prefer illustration. And that's why I was saying we need all skills as we work in futures team. We like to work with people who are able to produce fiction or art, innovative design to produce artifacts from the future, for example, storytelling, because what we want to do is to evoke emotions and reactions and ultimately provoke into action. So as I was saying, this sense of agency. And the last step, and really for me, it's probably the most important one because it kind of close the loop. The idea is now to come back to the present. So what does it mean in terms of action planning? So we call it backcasting, kind of mirroring forecasting. And the idea is to build a retro plan from such plausible futures and to design an actual action plan to go seize the opportunities we identify in those futures. So really, that's why I like to really insist on the fact that our approach is action-based and really deeply intertwined with strategy. And you've been mentioning Essex, so that's why also I think it's another important concept here, because as a consequence, ethics are a core component of our job. We have the ability, the capacity to lead decision makers to take decisions that will impact the building of our collective future, probably at different scales. So our recommendations as futurists, the one we provide, we need to be aware, to be conscious about what we provide in terms of advice. And usually we like to favor the development of positive futures, of futures that are diverse, equal, humane, and sustainable.
Absolutely superb. And can I just on that last point about sustainable or just sustainability, the environment, etc. I mean, one of the points I think is fascinating, it's been put forward by a lot of futurists over the last couple of years, when one is looking to the future from the perspective of the environmental catastrophe that is absolutely facing us. What about that issue of looking forward with a realistic mindset, an optimistic mindset, a more dystopian mindset? Where are you now on when one is looking at the genuinely mega meta issue, you know, of the environmental crisis?
Well, it's hard to remain hopeful most of the time. But once again, I would say there are two steps. For me, there's the step as a researcher. And as a researcher, I always try to see different scenarios and not favor one over the other. So mm-hmm. in some scenarios, you would be more catastrophic and imagine like the worst effects. And I'm thinking of the book Ministry for the Future that you probably read, where you can see the consequences on India from the start of the book. It really takes you, like it brings you by storytelling to what could be this type of extreme situation. So we need to see the different scenario so that we go into action, into what we could provide in terms of solution. And the book really does its really well, imagining what would be a process of taking action at very different scales, from the governmental to the individual. So maybe you can imagine catastrophe scenario, but it's always with the idea that you can act upon it and what would be the course of action to act upon it to make it ultimately better. But you can also imagine like more hopeful scenarios. And I was saying there are two steps. So there's the researcher step, and then there's, I would say, more the fiction writer step for me, because I also like to write fiction. And here, personally, I tend to be more hopeful. I tend to believe that together we are resilient, and you are probably the expert on that topic. So I should quote you probably. But we have some collective wisdom and some collective intelligence. Sometimes it's hard to find it, but we can develop the process to kind of make it work. And I do, I'm pretty hopeful and optimistic. I mean, the fact that we are reacting and questioning this already for me is a helpful step. The fact that people want to start taking action, and that we are trying to put in place policies and ethical committees, and for me, it's really hopeful signs. Like talking about the signals of change, I like to focus on those signals of change.
How interesting. I thought also that fascinating point you mentioned there about backcasting. I thought it was great, that work that was done recently by Region Australia, and you know, looking back from a future where a vast amount of sustainable innovation and activity and system change had taken place, and as they put it, you know, to show people the world they want to see via looking back at a decade that could be. I thought it was a really, really interesting way of putting that forward. And you mentioned again earlier on, holding back to the mighty William Gibson. I remember interviewing William many years ago when he wrote Pattern Recognition for Dave's magazine, and just what a giant figure he is. Okay, now just to your point about the metaverse, I'm really, really interested, and as I'm sure tons of people who are listening are, your go-to metaverse strategy and ethical design with brands. Just as a sort of interview from today, I was reading the New York Times earlier. It says that, quick quote from there, so Meta, the company formerly known as Facebook, commissioned a study that quantified economic opportunities in Web3 and estimated a gross metaverse domestic product of $3 trillion by 2031. Meanwhile, in the first quarter of this year, 2022, Meta lost $3 billion in Reality Labs, its division that experiments with virtual and mixed reality and other tech. So there we go, in terms of a utopian sort of perspective and one of a realism of today. So go on then. I'm really, really fascinated to hear what you have to say here, Sylvia. So your go-to metaverse strategy.
Thank you. That's definitely my favorite topic of the moment. And it's been underlying for a while, but we feel that this year, and probably around the announce of Meta Facebook renaming of Meta last year, something really clicked with the general audience. And if you look at the number of investments, the number of patents, there's really now clear signals that things are starting to become concrete. But still, the metaverse is a very blurry concept for many brands, whereas others are starting to actively seize those opportunities in virtual worlds. So what we decided to do at Silicon Humanism is to help pave the way towards the metaverse by expliciting strategic options for brands to enter the metaverse. Mm-hmm. Maybe to start with the world. So there's still some debate around an exact definition of the metaverse concept. Sure. So if I may, I'll focus here on the metaverse as persistent, immersive, mainly 3D virtual worlds, mm-hmm. enriched by all the Web3 technology and features, cryptocurrencies, NFTs, DAOs, and so on.
Yep.
So stemming from here, what we try to develop is really an approach that compare go-to-market strategy, which has been my specialty for years, mm-hmm. and go-to-metaverse strategy, meaning we compare the metaverse as a new territory that brands can conquer. Mm-hmm. And this new territory is characterized by a set of market specificities, let's say an audience of Gen Z and millennials and their avatar counterparts, new behaviors as early adopters explore social interaction, a new way of identifying, creation, collaboration, also monetization, community, and so on. New players also on all layers of the metaverse. New business models derived mm-hmm. from token-based economics and direct-to-avatar revenue streams. And then going along, emerging regulations and ethics to safeguard safety, privacy, and mental health. So considering all these dimensions will really contribute to building the foundations of a go-to-metaverse strategy. And then, why do we believe that brands need to establish a go-to-metaverse strategy? I like to mention four different reasons. Because if you go too fast, you will start inconsistent actions and activations. And that might not be the best way to think about the future. It might be more opportunities than really strategy. And when you enter strategy, you want to do it along specific planning. So first reason, the metaverse opens a range of new business strategy options. And really here, I like to insist on the fact that there's not one way to enter the metaverse and the best way is not to copy your neighbor. Really, entering the metaverse can offer sometimes an instant opportunity, such as a platform to launch a new product or promote your event. It can be a short digital campaign that you turn 3D or short-term partnership with another brand. But you can also actively inhabit the metaverse to enable extending an online store, for example, or even replicating a full physical store. You can also develop an aggressive customer acquisition strategy, like going to meet your customers where they are, or even becoming the core piece of your omnichannel strategy. This is really the metaverse as a new channel in the way of an omnichannel strategy.
I thought this was fascinating there that last week Spotify announced, so they're going to let musicians incorporate NFT projects into their profiles. And then Citizen M, the Epic hotel chain, announced they're going to begin the construction on a virtual hotel in the sandbox. So they said the virtual hotel is going to offer a place for avatars to work, sleep, and play. Nice. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I butted in,
absolutely.
Sylvia.
Absolutely, these are great examples. No, absolutely.
But you're saying also that it's really costly, though. So perhaps just unpack that. So the investment angle is costly.
Exactly. Why? Yes. Second thing, indeed, it's also costly depending on what you want to do. But if you want to go full activation, it can be costly. And if the audience is not there, or if it's not meant to your audience, maybe it's not worth it. So we really want to build a go-to metaverse plan so that we don't burn resources by just blindly replicating what other players do. And maybe too often some brands are led by their competitors' PR, and there's a lot of PR. You can search articles around metaverse and you think this or this other brand is doing something in the metaverse. And it's not even something in the metaverse. It's just the way they've been branded it.
Yeah.
They've been branding it. So you really have to do your benchmark closely and understand really what kind of experience they are developing and what kind of experience you want to develop as a brand and not just copy-paste another initiative by adding some in-house brand coding. You really need to do your homework because it does not serve a long-term strategy. It drags cost along the way. So we recommend to tailor the metaverse experience to the overall brand strategy, to adapt it to your very specific audience and make sure that the audience is on the platform that you are developing your experience. So yeah, at this point, I'd say to brands, like, ask yourself, what do you want to achieve really by entering the metaverse?
Can I just jump in on that one? I thought it was just really fascinating. Again, just something that I just saw the other day on exactly that, your point about the in-house angle of it. So Accenture bringing all their new hires into the metaverse, according to Fortune, as in Fortune magazine. So Accenture using its metaverse space called the Nth Floor to onboard 150,000 new workers this year. Whoa.
Ooh, yeah.
So, and then, and you mentioned, also mentioned the whole thing about the ecosystem. So it's still in the process of being built. So yeah, again, perhaps just to clarify
And at very different levels, like all the infrastructure to the back office, to the front office, to the metaverse activations from brands, everything is in the middle of being built. And it's hard to know exactly which player are going to be still there in 10 years. So as the boundaries and game rules are still being defined, I like to say to brands that you need to identifies the strategic players in the field. Which one are your competitors? Which one could be potential partners? Which other possible new entrants you might expect in the upcoming years, as well as the very role you want your brand to play in future scenarios. And this leads me actually to the fourth point, which connects with our previous conversation. Once again, a strategic foresight approach gives us agency. And as we plan ahead, we need to define an action plan, a timeline, a budget, resources, partnerships, key objectives, risk assessment. You see some brands doing it very smartly at Coca-Cola, at Nike. You see they are investing in hiring for those positions. You see they are building a new entities, new departments within the companies, are acquiring very aggressively some of the company. So envisioning possible metaverse futures related to your business, be it the future of fitness in the metaverse, or the future of entertainment, music, storytelling, or the future of food services as McDonald's or Panera are looking for, or Wendy's. So you look at these possible metaverse futures, and then you identify opportunity areas in those futures. So these are foresight tools we need to use to backcast and build a full-scale go-to-metaverse action plan. These
That's
are the four
pillars. Brilliant. Well, that's so interesting. Thank you. I thought it was interesting. So elsewhere, Wired magazine, talking about the American military opening a new front in the metaverse using virtual and augmented reality as a new training ground for the future. Meanwhile, back on this side of the Atlantic, Financial Times having a bit of a go, a bit of fun looking at how the metaverse is opening whole new professional class of people who talk about it. So one of those. Yeah. So very good. But then in terms, just to finish that off, because I think it's brilliant the way that you just clarify what is often seen as being something that is very, very opaque. So just in terms of the four components, your viewpoints there in terms of your, again, the go-to strategy you have on it. So perhaps just unpack the four components and then we'll talk about another issue. But it'd be brilliant if you could do that.
Exactly. So we are in a podcast. I cannot display here the picture, but really you have to imagine
in
it
the
as
future.
Yeah, you can envision it maybe. So really what we try to do is we try to develop an experience in the metaverse with brands. Okay. And what we do is we need to include four components by designing this experience. The first one is the strategic options you have, the go-to-metaverse strategy, reviewing and understanding all strategic options in the realm of the metaverse, investigating activation levers, connecting strategic tools and activation levers. What does it mean if you want to apply that strategy in terms of features you will develop? Mm-hmm. The second thing, the second input in this experience is the brand strategy. It's about prioritizing your brand strategic goals, expliciting your brand's identity, the mm-hmm. story, the values, you know, gathering all the current digital assets you have. The third input is more about technology adoption, understanding the different metaverse platforms, as well as everything that Web3 has to offer in terms of capabilities, features, new business models, and question what is available today, what is feasible, what is viable, and what is upcoming. And that's mm-hmm. the fourth input. Once again, the futures envisioning. And, yep. and I guess that's really the fourth, because we are on the platform, on the technology, that is thing being built. So there's what you can see today, but there's the potential of it. So that you need to add this input as you design the experience, the futures envisioning. Envisioning the future of your industry in the metaverse. Projecting your brand's customer journey in that metaverse. Imagining, for example, a day in the life of your customers. Identifying mm-hmm. some areas of development and opportunities for your brand in such futures. And very important, including a strong ethical component as how you choose the futures you want to sustain.
Mm-hmm. Really, really interesting. Thank you for that. I thought also fascinating the sort of viewpoint from Deloitte. And, you know, when they talk about the things one needs to know about it, I thought really interesting the angle of, they say, you know, so you should start with social impact and work back, as you were just saying. And also I think really interesting they're talking about learning from our mistakes with the internet. So they say, you know, we didn't really have a clear idea of what problems it solved and how best to use it back in the day when it kicked off. But now we can to have a sort of different viewpoint on this. And I think the crucial thing that Deloitte talk about there, which I think links totally into your thinking, is, as they say, you know, think big, start small, and test often.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to a different subject, I think, and it's a big leap, but perhaps not that big a leap. So, well-being for futurists and trend researchers of all descriptions, the well-being sector has been a fascinating one to be part of for years. But I think you, in particular, you've got a really, really interesting take on this, particularly from the perspective of what is clearly becoming a global mental health crisis. So, perhaps just talk a bit about your take on mental health and, as you put it, I think, hacking HR and well aging, which I think is such an interesting way also of linking to that side of things. But, mental health first.
Thank you, Sean. And I think we resonate with our thinking here as you talk about hope, resilience, community. All mm. these concepts for me are really key as what is happening right now. And yeah, indeed, I am particularly interested in the very topic of global mental health crisis, global well-being. And it has been reaching many levels during the pandemic, of course, with public health anxiety, economic insecurities, the transposition of many activities, including work to the home and sometimes in toxic home environments. Mm-hmm. But we have to know also that there were signs before this global mental health crisis had already started long before in society at large. You can think of the Me Too movement, sure. Gender inequalities. You still have an enormous amount of young girls forced into marriage and unable to receive an education all over the world. We talk also about a burnout epidemic, I think, before mental health. That was the big word, burnout. And there were also recurring reminders around work-life balance. So this is really a long-term trend that has gained in importance with the pandemic that's been accelerated probably. So with the pandemic acting as this catalyst, social chaos, riots and violence, thinking in the US but in other parts of the world now, the mental health crisis has resonated everywhere. From the Black Lives Matter movement to the Olympic world, you know, with some athletes opening up about their mental health condition, to the corporate world as well. You know, with CEOs now acting as role models, and you have it also in virtual worlds, connecting with our previous topic, where we are working on implementing safety measures and providing emotional and psychological support. Mm-hmm. So there's a common ground in all the topics we addressed at Silicon Humanism, be it related to the future of the home, the future of work, or the future of health and aging. Mm-hmm. And it's really the belief that the future is not only technological, that we need to replace the human element at the core. And don't get me wrong, when I say human, I mean human in relationship to the planet and other species. It's not like human yep. over the rest. It's really yep, human yep. as part of an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And of course, technology plays a major part of it. But the whole idea behind this Silicon Humanism initiative is that we need to connect or maybe reconnect technology and humanities. Mm-hmm. And connecting back to our first question around my background and so on, I tend to favor holistic and multidisciplinary approaches as I study a topic. Yep. And that's why my training in social science and foresight serves me here. Mm. How can we enjoy the advancement of technology? And how can we keep our sanity thanks to sometimes tech-free bubbles, getting out of tech, disconnecting? How can we reintegrate connections to nature, exercising, healthy, enjoyable nutrition, community bonding, intergenerational initiatives as well? And also artistic, intellectual, spiritual nourishment. Being human is really all this. And maybe to give you an example. Thank you. As we consider well-aging, so well-being as we age, when we study that topic, we focus not only on technology, once again, not only on smart technology that empower people. This is indeed a piece of the solution, but there are so many other components. And this technology actually acts much better in relationship to all the other components, social, spiritual, intellectual, natural, intergenerational. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And maybe another example, when we study the future of the home, and we recently published a research on the home of the 2020s with a focus on mental health at home. Yeah. So before the pandemic, most of the work on the future of the home focused on smart homes and how technology could empower its inhabitants.
Yeah.
But with the pandemic, it really pushed us to revise this model by introducing this other dimension. Mm. We aim to not only consider the home as a structure. It is a structure, but it's not only a structure. We yeah. also consider the home as a set of intangibles, a space, a time, a sharing of practices, of schedules, mental mm-hmm. health at home, and in other words, what we generally call home life. Mm. And so by doing our job as futurists, we've been scanning for signals of the future, collecting data and analyzing how people have been living throughout the pandemic, as well as the limitations of our current housing systems to deal with extreme situations. Mm-hmm. And as you know, extreme situations have unfortunately become mainstream during the yep. pandemic. It was probably like a field test, you know, to test, to see the endurance, the resilience of our housing. And the notion of resilience, which you're familiar with, is really both ways, structural resilience, the resilience of the materials, but also psychological resilience. And this has been key in rethinking the future of the home.
Very good. Whoa, that's some seriously big thinking there. And I do like a bit of, it also has sort of a psychological angle. A big shout out to the mighty sort of Carl Rogers, one always has to do that with a bit of self-actualization about balancing self-worth and self-image and the ideal self and all of that sort of things. I think it's an absolutely fascinating way of looking at and observing and thinking about the home in across those dimensions and reinterpreting, as you're saying, what we term home life. Okay, then, as the time is slightly against us, because we'd be talking a lot, it's been absolutely brilliant. I mean, thank you so much for your insights there. Okay, so in terms of where we are now heading and the paths that may be ahead of us, perhaps just talk a bit about that in terms of what we should be thinking about, possibly worrying about or feeling happy about in terms of short and sort of medium term futures, and how we should or how we or indeed organizations should deal with those perhaps sort of scenarios.
If you don't mind, I will pursue along the same thread, because I think
please do
like this lens of mental health, liminality, well-being, this global mental health crisis, we need to develop resilience at every level. So that's really something that's dear to me as we are working on the future. It can be psychological resilience for the individuals, which means providing the tools, the resources, the processes for the individuals to feel safe, to express, to recollect themselves, to develop inner strength. The second level is structural resilience for the organizations, the companies, the institutions, the cities, the buildings, the homes. And finally, at the level of our government and society, it's collective resilience, resilience of our markets as well. And if I may just rapidly give another example, the future of work, it's also similar what happened in the field. For a while, it was all about climbing Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, up from the safety needs, security needs, belonging, and performance needs to really go to the self-realization.
Yep.
So we would go from ERP or mostly administrative HRIS to social belonging and corporate tools like Office Vibe, Supermood, Culture IQ, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then there was this all new market of improved performance management systems, including colleague feedbacks. So we were climbing at the esteem level of the pyramid.
Yep.
To finally, ultimately reach peer recognition, employee empowerment, and chief happiness officer. And so that was really what happened like this past 50 years, let's say.
Yep.
But this also was kind of shattered, or at least there was an inflection this past 2 years, 2-3 years. It's as if we would climb down the pyramid, or that's really how I've been feeling it through all the signals we've collected.
Yep.
We realized that we needed to address the most basic needs of the individuals before even thinking of, you know, those fancy reward systems and perks. So employers realized that some of this was more like varnish to cover more subtle problems and challenges met by the collaborators. So the focus is now back to providing safety and security and make sure that employees can take care of their mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a little advocating for what I call a new care act at work, or at work from home, because it's still the case of many people over the world.
Yeah.
And what I mean with that is that business leaders need to go beyond that type of old-fashioned paternalism to really sign up for a redesigned care act towards their workforce, which is better suited to the new context of increased remote work.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were seeing, like mental health, it isn't a shameful private matter anymore. It has become more of a society concern. People express about it, they open up about it, and as we were mentioning, we've been witnessing it in the sports competition, for example.
Mm-hmm. I think also, by the way, I think, can I just jump in there? I think it's just really interesting to look at that particular issue on a global scale and just see how different cultures, different societies actually deal with it. I mean, I'm on a sort of completely personal basis researching this for a sort of very, very big brand. And it's fascinating to talk with people about mental health issues, let's say in China versus South America or North America or Northern Europe, you know, and to have a very, very different perspective being fed back from the point of view of how wherever they were physically, how the cultures actually dealt with that whole issue. So, absolutely fascinating.
Yes, there's a full cultural dimension of it.
And
indeed, I tend to have maybe more of a North American point of view, even if I actually conducted a comparative study between France and California. We have two different cultures of work, and trust is a very important piece of all this. The way we relate to trust within the work environment was very different in the French system and in the Californian system, for example, and really had a lot of consequences during this phase of working from home. But indeed, like conducting more intercultural studies in that field would also enable us to understand the very nature of work and labor in different cultures, and what can be put in place locally to make sure we align locally and not just put in place general policy.
Absolutely fascinating. Okay, and then moving on from that, and I say I've again been very happy to have talked about nothing but that for a long, long time. But in terms of times, I know time is against you. You're a busy person. So just in terms of so stepping back from this and thinking, okay, I know you work with a ton of really interesting organizations and companies, you know, across the board, legacy brands and startups, etc. So anyone that you could point at and say, now there's a really interesting company or organization that's just doing it properly, that's really have got themselves sorted out. Do you have any sort of particular favorites that you think
it's leading from the front? Pick just one, but I'm impressed by what Lego is doing, for example, or Disney with Story Living. And for me, it really relates with what I've been saying as, these intergenerational initiatives and senior villages, and seeing it come live from actually the foresight team as Disney is really, really interesting.
Right.
And then everything connecting with mental health and what's happening in the metaverse right now with all the VR health applications in promoting exercising, healthy eating, mental health support, to help generate empathy, revive social bonding, stimulate memory. So there's not just one I can name, but many startups, many companies at different scale are trying to build experiences to support our communities. And I think that that's really something I'm hopeful about. And in terms maybe of naming a few, if I may, I'll just name the ones I'm actually so happy to have been collaborating with for the past few years.
Yeah, please do.
So the Sustainable Ocean Alliance is doing an amazing work by promoting ocean tech startups. And that's amazing to see how, once again, this innovation is coming from very different players, not just the big players, but tons of entrepreneurs are willing to join the effort. And I'm also very involved with Grace One Girls, with Hacking HR, with the Web3 Summit, and with the Association of Professional Futurists, with Future Agency, Using Foresight, the Design Futures Initiative, GEM3, Media Monks. Yeah, all those players are incredibly doing like an incredible job in the field. So big shout out to all my friends here and there.
Fantastic. I like it. Okay, then. And then another really great thing I want to talk to you about, and that is, we can talk about this one for many days, but ethics and philosophy. So go on then. So ethics and philosophy, but particularly through the prism of the sort of Future Think Tank and Grey Swan activity that you've been up to, because I think everyone will be really interested to hear about your take on it there.
Thank you for asking. That's indeed something very important to me, because during the pandemic, as I was saying, I was studying the future of the home, and I connected with an amazing team of psychologists at Grand Rapids, and specifically Paul Cross has been very helpful. So yep. Paul invited me first on a podcast to discuss philosophy and psychology of futures. And from there, we started exchanging ideas on futures thinking, but not just futures thinking as we are conducting it with brands or businesses, but also futures thinking as a therapy to help deal with anxiety and once again to regain agency over one's life, but more at the personal level, at the individual level.
Yeah.
And while working on this, we also digged into philosophy and wondered why the future hadn't been addressed as such by philosophers, why there isn't namely a philosophy of the future. So this series of conversations mainly led to more conversations and more research until I gave a conference on the topic at the Global Foresight Summit organized by an association of professional futurists.
Yeah.
And the lecture, which I had a personal interest in it, I find it fascinating studying it, but I wasn't expecting that it has so much echo. But following the lecture, I got many questions and people reached out to me to continue the conversation. And we decided to start building a think tank on the topic. And APF has been amazingly supportive. We started a discussion group now a year ago within APF. We are gathering about 50 to 70 futurists each month to address the topics, very varied topics around ethics and philosophy of future. So, for example, we had Wars of the Future with Rob Gayoso. Bioethics with Timothy Dolan. We talked about morals of machines with Lida Whitsett. We talked about indigenous philosophies with Marcus Busset, alien tech cosmologies with Raphael Bido Waddington. And the two last one were Latin American Afrofuturism with Ana Paula Medeiros and ethical design with Greg Solis, to name most of them. But our goal is not just to organize events or lectures. It's really to have people co-design principles of ethical futures. What does it mean to be a futurist? What is our responsibilities? When we provide advice, when we provide recommendation, we have to be accountable. We have to be responsible for it because we talk to decision makers, so they can influence the work. So indirectly, we influence what is built in the future. So that's why we really think we need to build, to write down a set of guidelines, of principles to help guide our practice as ethical futurists.
I think great. I mean, I also think that fascinating topic that always comes up at these events in terms of sort of the politics of the future and political policy, and often said that the left are suspicious of the future because they want the present to be put right, whereas the right far prefer looking backwards to a supposedly sort of golden past. So one of those. And I think certainly Karl Popper would have something to say about the future. But so in terms of the Grey Swan Guild, perhaps just clarify that.
Thank you for asking. Yeah, so Grey Swan Guild, they really have been closer to a family during the pandemic. I started as a contributor, then became a board member, and I have been active in many of their ventures. I really support like most of what they do. So Grey Swan Guild is now celebrating its second anniversary. The founders, Shen Moffitt and Rob Tyrie, very close friend now, came together in response to the first shocks that felt during the COVID-19 pandemic. The idea was really to discuss the impact of the crisis and the road ahead for people, business, economy, so at every scale. Today, the network is really global, counts more than 5,000 members in 100 countries. And everybody has kind of the same spirit, this common desire to make sense of the world's biggest challenges, and also to try to predict or warn for the next gray swans. So we've been working together on many, many topics, from bringing content to panel conversations, podcasts, conferences, clubhouse conversations, Zoom workshops, debates, sense-making salon. We also launched a weekly news wrap now more than a year ago. And the idea is to review what happens in the world through the sense-making lens. And maybe one of my favorite is a recent project called Future Gazing for Teens. And the objective is to empower teens' futures.
Very nice.
What's fascinating is that the community is really in the process of being turned into something more business-oriented now. What we've been doing, I would say, for ourselves by offering all that type of conference, now we are trying to provide the same services to corporations or institutions interested in to bringing their own members to this sense-making level. The energies, the synergies, all the brilliant minds and kind hearts as well I've met at Grey Swan Guild have really brightened my days during the pandemic and still do. every day.
Very good. Nice. And then just in terms of taking that forward, I mean, you mentioned, by the way, earlier on, we talked about something you've been reading recently, the Ministry for the Future. Just in terms of other interesting things that you could recommend for the listeners, what else is out there that you are particularly fascinated by at the moment?
So I try to still get some time to read. And I would say my recent happy discovery were God, Human, Animal, Machine, by Wired Cloud Support author Megan O'Giblin. She's mm-hmm. amazing. Like I love the Wired column, but I love her book as well. It's really about thinking about, why do we tend to think that machines can be sentient? What does it tell about us? What's the limit of consciousness? I don't know. It has so many questions. It's really a philosophy treaty. More maybe in the fiction realm, I love Machines Like Me by Ian McEwan. Sorry, I might not pronounce it right.
It's superbly, the French accent. Yeah, go on.
And Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro also is a really a lovely one. And maybe if I may, a personal favorite, which is not a future or speculative fiction book, but which relates, I think, with mental health and resilience and all these notions we've been mentioning since the beginning of the conversation. It's called Anxious People by Swedish author Fredrik Backman.
Nice. Talking about Sweden, I was in Stockholm recently giving a speech with old Kjell Nordström, the epic economic futurist, gave me a copy of his brilliant Corona Express. And I'm currently on the Globotics Upheaval, the Richard Baldwin book. But then, go on then, what about next big thing in your life then? What's coming up?
Hard to find one, but I would say, so I'm, let's say, not regular, but I try to remain a fiction writer. I really love that means, that way to express myself. So stay tuned. I'm hoping to publish a future fiction book sometime soon.
Fantastic. Okay, then last couple of points. And that is, so as you know, and throughout the couple of series of the podcasts that I've done with, just like yourself, some absolutely fascinating guests, the core themes of hope, community and resilience have been the sort of the golden thread that I've tried to weave through them all. So perhaps just give us, I know you mentioned a couple of those already, but just to clarify your take on hope, community and or resilience.
Well, I'm really glad we connected from the start, because I feel so much resonance between your ethos and the way you're thinking about community and resilience and the way we've been working about it. So really, really love that approach.
Thank you.
Well, resilience is a key concept of our work on mental health, future of work, future of the home, and community, collaboration, co-creation, all the multidisciplinary approach, listening to each other, accepting the skills of other, building on top of each other, co-designing, and on top of that, empathizing. For me, it's key to building collective, positive, ethical, and sustainable futures. I would say, maybe once again, as I was saying at the start of our conversation, I'm mostly a hopeful futurist. And when I work on projects, I try to create these multiple scenarios. That's our methodology. But when I work on fiction pieces, when I write short stories, for example, I have a more personal approach, which I like to characterize by bittersweet nostalgia. I am a big fan of technology. I've been working on it. My father has introduced me to it a while ago. So I'm mostly enthusiastic about scientific and technological advancement. But I also do believe that we are not just technological beings, that we are mostly social and moral animals. And the pandemics really proved that globally.
Sure.
For me, like at the peak of the pandemic, we were missing being with each other, the human warmth, real interactions. We were missing being in nature when parks were closed. We had to shelter in place. So I believe in those technology-free bubbles. Sometimes we need to disconnect, to extract ourselves from the digital sphere, to go back to our own selves for the sake of our mental health. So that's why I like to develop stories in which I focus on the human and social aspect in technology supercharged world, and how we can resist and continue to develop and be resilient in sometimes adverse worlds. How would you feel if you had to download your memory before you die? How would you feel if you had to disconnect from life to avoid overpopulation? Or what would it be like to be homesick when you live on Mars? Will you be missing Earth? Will you be missing the waves? What will a human being living on Mars feel towards Earth as they grow up far from it? Is there something like an Earthling gene? And these are examples of topics I love to explore in my fictions.
Whoa.
Sorry, I could take a long time about it.
Yeah, absolutely superb. And then as we're reaching the end of our allotted time, and I say it would have been absolutely brilliant to have gone on for a lot longer, but I'm aware that you're busy. So go on then. So where can listeners track you down then? Where can they find you?
Sorry, I'm not very popular on TikTok or Instagram. I'm definitely more a LinkedIn person. So LinkedIn is my favorite social media tool. I have 30K followers and a Silicon Humanism LinkedIn page. So you can join us. I love that. I also have a blog called Silicon Humanism. And once again, Silicon Humanism is really a call to action to replace the human component at the core of our technological advancements. How can we design together futures that integrate with our human specificities and value human life without damaging our environments? So we aim to explore these contradictions and synergies between technology and humanities and envision how our future will look like. So if you're interested, too, please join us.
Absolutely. Well, I sincerely hope that many more do, which and I'm sure the vast amounts already are there. But on a final note then, so just like to say thank you so much to Sylvia Galusa, the strategist and futurist, who also founded the fantastic Silicon Humanism.
Thank you for having me. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. Just so you know, the trends and insights discussed in these podcasts link to my speeches. Check out seanpdc.com for more info, and to ongoing cultural and social research conducted by brandpositive.org.
Till next time, goodbye.